and welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, June 16, 2018. My name is Martin. This is the episode of the week I like to call the top of the pile, in which I talk about some of my favorite books that I read on past New Comic Book Day. And this past week was a really interesting week for me. I want to apologize first for not releasing a bunch of episodes last week. I got super tied up with things, so I was not able to record a whole lot. But I'm back, and I do have a full week planned this week. Some stuff based upon some of the books that I read last week. In fact, I'm going to talk about Die, Die, Die number one today. And on Wednesday's episode, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the strategy behind this new Robert Kirkman book, which I think is really interesting. And I want to talk about how publishers can generate a little bit more excitement for the readers, not just by doing crazy outlandish stunts like, I don't know, let's just say spoiling the ending of comic books in the New York Times, but how publishers can do really interesting things that excite people without pissing them off. So we'll see how that goes. Unlike last week, I did read a bunch of books this past week. I think I read 24 books last week. That might be a little off. I think it might have been actually a little bit more than that. But unlike last week, I didn't have a hard time picking what books I wanted to talk about. In fact, today I'm going to be talking about 9 books. We've got, 2 Marvel, 1 Aftershock, 3 Image, 2 DC, and 1 Action Lab Danger Zone. It was a really solid week, but there was not a whole lot that blew me away unlike last week, which I found really interesting. And maybe I'll be rethinking the way that I read some of these books. I do want to kick off, of course, talking about Die, Die, Die number 1. This is an Image comic from Robert Kirkman and Chris Burnham, Scott Gimple, and Nathan Fairbairn. And this is the book that I talked about last week that had no announcement. Nobody knew it was coming. Basically, what happened was this book, the news of this coming out was dropped either late Monday or early Tuesday, basically saying, hey, Kirkman's got this new book out. It's called Die, Die, Die. It'll be out tomorrow. And a lot of people were a little confused. And I think judging by the reactions of what I've seen on Twitter, at least, it seems like this book has been pretty well received. Now, again, I'm not going to talk about the whole marketing strategy behind it, but I think it's fascinating, and I definitely want to talk about it. But I do want to talk about the book itself today. And I really wasn't quite sure what to think about this book when it was announced last Tuesday. I did know that I wanted to pick it up because, really, the synopsis that was given was very... how can I put this? It wasn't very good. It wasn't very good. It didn't really tell me what the book is about. In fact, I received the email from Image, I think Monday night or Tuesday morning, telling me about this book, and it was like hidden. The announcement was hidden inside like a Key Collectors comics app advertisement. I don't know. It was really odd, but I did read the book, and I thought it was quite enjoyable. Now, this will not be, I think, something that a lot of people will enjoy. Let me rephrase that. This will be a book that some people will definitely not enjoy. It is very much over-the-top gore fest. In fact, I don't know if I would compare this to really any other Kirkman book. And technically, I think Kirkman maybe didn't write this. He was maybe more like a creator slash plotter, maybe a co-writer. I think the reason for that is the majority of this book was written by the guy that was helming the Walking Dead TV show. So this is kind of a way for him to get into comics. And of course, he's no longer running the show. There's a new showrunner over there. Because apparently, according to Kirkman in the back matter, he wanted to write comics. And I thought that was so fascinating. Because usually what we see is the other way around, right? We have creators creating a book in the hopes that it will sell very well, in the hopes that it will get optioned for TV or film. And then maybe they don't need to write comics anymore. Or they can just write comics in order to treat them for film or TV, kind of like we see with Mark Miller nowadays. And I know I didn't talk about the Magic Order. I'm not going to talk about the Magic Order too much yet. To be honest, I don't know why I didn't talk about it that much. I think part of the discussion I had about the book was when I had Aaron Bell on last month, and the book did really well, by the way. I'll talk about that later on in the week when I do a little sales recap for the month of June. But yeah, this was actually really interesting because Die, Die, Die in many ways reminds me of a Mark Miller book, not so much a Robert Kirkman book. And that was interesting because I have a love-hate relationship with Mark Miller stuff. And for some reason, this one really worked for me. I think the fact that there was a really good, interesting, fleshed out backstory to a lot of these characters really cemented this as something a little more enjoyable than the typical hyperviolent gore fest that I see in books like Kick-Ass, for example. And basically, to recap what the story's about is there is a secret cabal within the U.S. government run by this senator, Senator Lipschitz, which I thought was a pretty funny name. I know it's a real name, but it's still kind of funny whenever I hear it. The cabal is run by her. She basically runs this covert agency within the government where she can kind of change world events to suit, we'll say, democracy as a whole. Some of the stuff that they do is maybe a little up in the air. Like, you gotta think whether this is for personal gain, and they do say that some of it is for personal gain, but the majority is to kind of fit what the government wants to do around the world. And, there's a really great couple of pages, detailing exactly how this works. Matter of fact, I believe it was, a member of parliament in the UK that she wants to get rid of, because he's a pedophile and she hates pedophiles. And of course, I think that's a pretty valid thing, right? You want to get rid of the pedophile in government because you don't want pedophiles or, you know, whatever kind of criminal running a government. And she wants to figure out the best way to get rid of this guy. And the whole thought process behind it was really fascinating. It was almost like a Rube Goldberg machine where, you know, like you knock down one thing and then a series of events happens that leads to the ultimate goal. So she thinks about it. She's like, well, you know, if I kill the guy, then he's going to be a martyr because he's doing all this great stuff in government. And I don't want him to be a martyr because he's a douchebag. He's a pedophile. I just want to get rid of him. So she realizes, okay, there's this guy running against him for the parliamentary seat. Maybe I could just find a way for the guy to win. And then he loses the election and I don't have to kill him. He's going to kill himself. He's going to hang himself because he lost the election. And then we can spin that in the newspaper, right? Even though he's actually not going to kill himself, she's going to get one of her assassins to do it. He's not going to be seen as a martyr because pretty much the way it'll go in the newspaper says, well, he lost the election. He killed himself. So she goes through this whole process and she's like, well, the only way that this guy's going to beat the pedophile is if he wins this contract with the railways. And right now it's not looking too good because there's another group that wants to stop the railways because the new railroad tracks are going to cut through the children's playground. And so she goes to that person leading that movement. She's like, well, you know, this guy's not too bad. I don't want to kill him because he's not a bad person. Like, sure, he cheats on his wife because remember, there's a covert spy agency. So they know everything about everybody. It's like, this guy is cheating on his wife, but he's a really good family man. You know, he's got kids. He doesn't deserve to be killed. How can I stop this guy from trying to stop the movement to build the railroad tracks so this other guy can win so I can get rid of the pedophile? So she starts looking at his family and she's like, oh, I can do this. I can do that. Well, no, that's not a good thing. How about we do something with his mom? Because his mom's really sick. Maybe we can get him to go and take care of his mom. But he doesn't really need that because his mom's got a caretaker who's very happy with his job. And, you know, he's probably going to be there for several years. Until she realizes that, well, you know, maybe if the guy won the lottery, then he would no longer work for this woman. The guy would have to move to take care of his mom. He'd be very happy there because it's out in the country. Would no longer need to try to stop this railroad from being built. The new guy, the incumbent, would actually come in and win the election. Then the pedophile would lose the election. He would no longer be in power. We can kill him and frame it as he committed suicide. And that's what they do. So a really, really fascinating series of events. I love the way that was done. I actually enjoy that a little bit more than the rest of it because we do get some of the scenes of the actual spy stuff where these guys are going to assassinate world leaders or whatever in order to make a certain event happen. And it's pretty obvious that the senator is not very happy. She's definitely based on Hillary Clinton, I would say, just judging by the way that, you know, she's illustrated. There's a scene where there's a picture of her and Obama, even though he's not called out by name. And, that was fascinating. And, you know, she just basically hangs out in her office in the dark all day, snorting cocaine and drinking whiskey. There's like a naked dude on the couch, so we don't know anything about that. Really, really fascinating. I love the world that is built in this particular issue of the book. And of course, it is extremely violent and gory because we do have assassins trying to kill people and counter-assassins trying to kill the assassins and stop them from killing. There's one scene that was extremely gruesome. And I mean, you could tell by the cover that this is going to be a gruesome book. But there's a scene where one of the spies is getting chased and runs into another group of spies, some of Senator Lipschitz people, and basically gets a katana sword shoved up his nose and chops the guy's nose off. Now, the guy's not killed, but you do see in very vivid graphic detail this guy's nose getting chopped, and man, was that gruesome. But really well done, and the art is fantastic on this. I really enjoyed it. There's a lot of other characters in the background that I hope get a good bit of exploration on them because they seem like really interesting characters. For example, Senator Lipschitz goes to dinner with this one lady who may be part of one of these other cabals that are trying to do covert ops, and blames it for her agent getting his nose cut off. And I want to learn more about her. I want to learn about these guys. I want to learn about some of these secret agents that we don't really see. Like, there's a guy that gets the group goes in search of this one guy who happens to be the noseless guy's brother. And that guy's got two brothers, apparently, and they may be spies as well in some way. I think they're triplets. They look like triplets. They might not be. But all that stuff is really, really interesting. So overall, I really enjoyed this first issue of Die, Die, Die number one. I think it's worth putting on your pull list. Definitely check it out if your store got it. And the way that this worked is if your store bought a copy of Oblivion Song number one, then it received the same number of copies for Die, Die, Die number one. Fascinating way to do it, by the way. And the next issue of this comes out August 22nd. So again, not solicited way ahead of time like we usually see, right? 2-3 months ahead. But I really love the fact that this is out there, and I highly recommend you pick it up. Die, Die, Die number one is going to be a 4 out of 5 for me. Really, really dug it. I want to move from there over to Marvel, and I want to start the Marvel train on a little bit of a, I don't want to say a sad note. That's probably the wrong thing to say. I was really excited to read Amazing Spider-Man number one. This is Nick Spencer and Ryan Otley. Of course, I love Ryan Otley. His stuff on Invincible was incredible. I really enjoyed Nick Spencer's stuff. I liked Secret Empire. I know there were some things not to like, but I really enjoyed it. I liked his Captain America run. And part of the problem was the overtly political stuff in there, right? Which made sense for Cap. And I was a little concerned that that may happen in Amazing Spider-Man number one, and I will say it does not. However, there are some political jabs thrown in here there, but you have to actually pay attention to actually get wind of them. And this is an oversized first issue, a lot of stuff going on here. I gotta say, I was not very impressed with the issue. I know I tweeted out a little bit about this, so people were chiming in. Right now, it looks like the opinion is about 50-50, love it or hate it. I'm not gonna say I hated it. I'm gonna just go ahead and get the rating out of the way. I'm gonna give it a 3 out of 5. I thought it was a good issue. But I don't think there was enough in here for me to want to pick up the next one. Of course, I do want to think about that a little bit more. And, you know, it's very seldom that I read a book and don't really have an opinion on it almost immediately. Or, you know, within the next couple of minutes after finishing the issue. But this is one that I'm not really sure what to think about it. And I hope that if you've read it, you would chime in. Let me know on Twitter at Geekvine what you liked about this book. I mean, if you didn't like it, you can chime in too, but I'm more curious about people that really enjoyed it, what you liked about it, and what I should be looking for to get more enjoyment out of it. Because, you know, I do believe in second chances, in particular with comics, and I want to like this because I want to read a monthly Spider-Man comic that is what Spider-Man really is to me. And I think in that respect, this book is successful, right? Because there's a lot of resetting going on in Amazing Spider-Man number one, where, you know, Peter's company has failed, so we don't have the Tony Stark Peter Parker. And by that I mean, you know, like when Peter had his company and basically played Tony Stark. That was fine, but like this is back to Peter just being Peter. He's not at the Daily Bugle anymore because he got fired. Because, you know, one of the main plot lines of this issue is that they find out that Doc Ock actually wrote his graduate thesis back when Doc Ock was Superior Spider-Man. And that whole thing was really interesting. I love the way that people react to him. I love the way that Aunt May reacts to him, how Mary Jane reacts to him. And like I said, a lot of this is resetting back the status quo. So Peter's not Daily Bugle. He is not, does not run this tech company. He doesn't have like a Spider-Mobile, right? It's just him and Aunt May, kind of. And Mary's really pissed off at him for the fake graduate paper. And, you know, him and Mary Jane are just kind of friends, although it seems maybe towards the end they're getting together. You know, I've talked a little bit about comic book characters being married, in particular last week when I was talking about Batman. But I don't mind when characters are in a relationship if it works, right? I do see a Batman-Catwoman relationship working, just like I see a Mary Jane and Peter Parker relationship working. Mary Jane's been part of his mythos for such a long time that I could definitely see it, and I hope that it works out. You know, it's interesting that they're resetting a lot of this stuff. I'm not sure how Marvel explains some of these things. You know, a lot of times we see new number one issues, and, you know, they're based on, I don't know, whatever. There's some, like, big cosmic event, and everyone loses their memory, or they go into another dimension or whatever. There's none of that here. It's just basically we're back to basics, and let's just go with that. And in some ways, I like that, right? Because I don't think we always need an explanation for why we're doing things, right? I mean, this is a new creative team. Of course, I talked about Dan Slott being on Spider-Man for 10-plus years. You know, Bendis was on Spider-Man for a while. This is Nick Spencer's take, and I think in some ways it works, right? He can actually do humor pretty well. And you have to have a comedic Spider-Man character, right? Not out of the craziness like Deadpool, for example. But, you know, you got to throw the jokes in. And that's in here. And there's a lot of demeaning Spider-Man in many ways too, right? Because first of all, everyone's beating up on him for this graduate thesis. And there's a lot of scenes here with the Avengers like fighting some kind of villain. And when Spider-Man pops in, they're like, oh, it's you. Like, oh, this guy again. And that was funny. But, you know, to me, it was almost on the side of overdone. Overall, I mean, I enjoyed it. I think the backup story with Mysterio, Mr. Mysterio, is really interesting. I want to see where that goes. In fact, I would have even preferred this issue to be mostly about that instead of all the additional things we got. The final page with the Lizard was really interesting, and I don't know if it seems weird that Connors as the Lizard would be a professor at a university, but maybe that is true, or maybe there's a lot more going on in here. Just based on the Mysterio story where he's kind of losing his mind and seeing a lot of things, I wonder if maybe some of the other stuff that we're seeing in this particular issue is not related to the new villain and maybe doing some kind of mind control or emotion control, kind of like we saw with Psycho Pirate in Batman. It's very possible, but art's fantastic, and I think it read pretty well. It's a little denser than I would want a Spider-Man book to be, but it was a fun read, and I did enjoy it. Whether it's a book that I want to continue picking up, I'm really not sure about that yet. I want to hear what people have to say about this book a little bit, and I think I'll definitely give it a couple of issues to make up my mind, but as of right now, I'm just not really sold on it. So Amazing Spider-Man number 1 is going to be a 3 out of 5. Another Marvel book that I read that I actually enjoyed quite a bit more was X-23. This is the new all-new Wolverine, and basically picks up directly from that book. This is Mariko Tamaki is writing this one. Art is Juan Cabal with colors by Nolan Woodard and letters by Corey Pettit. And I really, really actually enjoyed this, which is interesting because I don't think X-23 is necessarily a book for me in the tone of it, because a lot of the time it does seem like this is geared to a much younger audience. I don't want to say a female audience either, even though there's female characters and a female writer. But it does definitely have some of that sensibility. But I think you can definitely see through that if you look at these characters, because the majority of the issue centers around X-23 and Gabby, her younger sister, who is also a clone of her. And, you know, the clone thing plays a huge part of the story, and I'll get to that in a second. But so much of X and Gabby's, or Laura and Gabby's relationship is explored in this issue that I really, really enjoyed it. You know, first we see them fighting against a group of villains, which are, you know, pretty generic villains, but it was really interesting the way that they interact, how their personality is different, because Gabby is really always talking. Maybe that's why her name is Gabby, because she's always gabbing it up. Whereas Laura is a little more, she's a little quieter. She's more about getting things done. And I think that relationship worked pretty well. And Gabby was such an interesting character. You know, it made the book really fun to read and really made the story move forward quite a bit. And, you know, it does help us introduce the reader to a lot of the characters that we see, because, you know, sometimes Gabby hasn't met these people or is meeting them for the first time. And so she's very excited about talking to some of them and ask questions about them. And that was a really interesting way of doing character exposition, right? Without being like, here's a little caption, like, this is who this is what this character does. Like, that'd be kind of boring, right? And a lot of times character or writers resort to that kind of thing. And Tamaki did not hear, and it worked really well. I was very, very surprised by how well it worked. Now, of course, if you read All New Wolverine, you might be familiar kind of with the backstory and how we got to where we are. If not, then I don't think you need to worry about it, because this is a great introductory issue. The villain of this one seems to be the Stepford Cuckoos, whom I absolutely love because they're clones of the greatest mutant of all time, Emma Frost. Now, some of you may or may not know, there used to be 5 cuckoos, now there's 3 cuckoos. 2 of them got killed through different reasons, and those reasons are explained in this issue, so you can, if you read the issue, you'll know exactly what it is. But I loved how Tamaki characterized the cuckoos. I love the new character design that they have as well. And I know Gabby talks about that quite a bit in here, right? So I love that it's not quite breaking the fourth wall, but it was really interesting how that was brought about. I love the new costume. It's fantastic. And of course, since Laura and Gabby are clones, it would make perfect sense to have the villains of the story be the cuckoos, because they also are clones. And basically, it's really interesting because they meet the cuckoos at the X-Mansion, right? At the Institute. And they seem to be good people, right? Because they go there to do this, some kind of speech. I can't remember exactly what the speech was. Cause Gabby's like, oh, are you guys teaching here? And they're like, no, we came to do this presentation. And then we're out of here. So they're not quite villains, right? Because they're allowed there to teach. But, as we see as the story progresses, maybe they are, right? Because one of the professors or one of the doctors that was involved in the program that created X-23 is kidnapped, and apparently is kidnapped by the Stepford Cuckoos because they want to clone the 2 dead sisters. We'll go with sisters. I was trying to figure out what the word would be for like quintuplets, I guess. But yeah, so the 2 dead sisters, and manages to actually clone them. And of course, this woman is being held against her will, kind of, right? Like she's free to roam around, but she is constantly being mind controlled by the cuckoos because that's one of their main abilities. And we do see that these clones maybe aren't the most perfect of clones. You know, they were able to be cloned. They have the kind of the same personality, but they have a lot of ailments that, you know, what we know from cloning, a lot of that, you know, genetic manipulation can cause a lot of birth defects. And so these clones have aged very rapidly. They're very sick, one in particular. And I love the way the whole thing played out. In particular, there's a twist at the end that I don't want to give away, which I found really, really interesting. So I really dug X-23 much more than I was anticipating. I knew I was going to like it because I do like Tamaki's writing, but really, really fantastic. I know some people are complaining about why is this being reverted back to X-23 instead of All-New Wolverine, and I don't get that. I mean, to me, she's always been X-23, so even when they had her as the All-New Wolverine, that's when I was like, well, why is she the All-New Wolverine? Why can't she just be X-23? And, you know, I think X-23 is not the best of names. Matter of fact, I think it's somewhat of a terrible name. But the character's been around long enough where I think people recognize the name. And so if you put that on the title, it's okay. And I think Marvel has realized that, and maybe that's why the book is called that. But overall, I really enjoyed it. I'm going to rate this one a 4 out of 5. I really highly recommend picking this up. You know, Laura's such an interesting character, and I love this interaction between her and Gabby. I really look forward to seeing how this goes. And I'm assuming this is an ongoing, but, you know, you never know nowadays. But this is definitely going on my pull list. I really, really liked it. Let's go over to Aftershock and talk a little bit about Relay Number 1. Now, won't be talking about it a whole lot because, of course, I do an Aftershock podcast. So you can check that out at Aftershock Central Podcast. And available on your favorite pod directory, whatever that is. Relay is written by Zach Thompson with art by Andy Clark. And, you know, It's interesting because usually we are used to Zach Thompson, Lonnie Nadler writing together, and this is a solo outing. Now, there's a writing credit for Donnie Cates in this book, even though Donnie Cates is not writing this book. And there's a whole list of reasons why that is. I know Ronnie talked to Zach months ago, like right when this book was first announced, and talked to Donnie as well before that. And I think, if I remember correctly, part of the reason is Donnie and Zach are good friends. And of course, Donnie's been with Aftershock for a long time. One of the things that Donnie's doing is kind of helping with some of the creative direction at Aftershock. Of course, with him and Zach being friends, they kind of came on board and they, I can't remember what the exact story, the origin story of this book was, but they were chatting somehow and came up with this idea, and Zach kind of ran with it. So really the book is written by Zach. There's just a creator credit on here for Donnie Cates. So if you're a Donnie Cates fan, don't be like, oh my God, Donnie Cates is writing another book, let me go pick it up, because that's not the case. But it definitely has a lot of the sensibilities that Donnie likes, which of course Zach does as well. They have the same sci-fi interests. And this was a really interesting book. Again, I'm not going to talk about it in depth, but I really recommend you pick up the Free Comic Book Day Relay Number 0 issue. You can get it on Comixology for free if you did not pick up a copy. Highly recommend you do, because a lot of the stuff that happens in this issue directly ties into the 0 issue. There's a character that this society is looking for, Donaldson, who is the central character of the 0 issue. And by having read that, you know a little bit more about what the relay system is, who this Donaldson character is, where he's from, maybe, you know, why he's doing things, maybe, not really. And I think it gives you a lot of interesting backstory to understand the story of Relay Number 1 a little bit more. But basically, this is in the future, and there's a monolith on Earth, and the monolith creates kind of a monoculture, right, where everyone has the same ideals and shared technology. And there's a relay system across the galaxy. So, you know, the relay charges people in kind of colonizing new planets and spreading the message of the relay. So, there's a whole galaxy of inhabited planets that have relays and live by the relay's rules with the relay's technology. And, you know, some people really like that and some people hate it. And so, of course, you always have groups revolting against the status quo. And really, really fascinating stuff in here. If you're a fan of, like, really hard-hitting sci-fi, you'll definitely like this. There's a lot to like. If you're a fan of, like, Blade Runner, there's a lot of that in here. Or, Blade Runner, 2001, A Space Odyssey, anything by Philip K. Dick. Of course, Zach's a huge Philip K. Dick fan, but really fantastic. And the art is gorgeous on here. I've followed Andy Clark for quite a while, and I mean, this might be some of the best stuff he's ever done. I mean, even from the beginning, like the first couple of pages are, they're full pages with like insert panels, and they're just gorgeous to look at. In fact, it's really interesting. When the book opens up, they're on this, flying taxi cab, and there's a small fight that happens in the cab, and one of the characters gets thrown off. And when he gets thrown off, the whole shape of the book shifts, and all the panels get flipped sideways, and it makes it a little tougher to read. I wish the captions and the word balloons would have been kept right side up, but it's really interesting because you gotta like turn the page, and you're falling as the character's falling. Really interesting stuff on here. Really, really fascinating world, really interesting story. This is definitely one that's going to take quite a few issues to fully understand what's happening, but I loved it. I really, really loved it. I think Zach's a fantastic writer, and this is the perfect book for him to be doing. I definitely recommend Relay Number 1. This is going to be a 4 to 5 as well. Let's go over to Image and talk a little bit about She Could Fly Number 1. This is written by Christopher Cantwell, who is the creator of Halt and Catch Fire, a show which I absolutely adore. And it's basically set in the early age of computers. Basically, the company that is founded in this series is, I guess the closest analog would be Compaq. I don't know if anybody remembers Compaq, but basically the first IBM-compatible PC. Nowadays, we have Apple and we have PCs, and that's about it, right? Back in the day, there were so many different kinds of computers. And, you know, IBM had the IBM personal computer. And people started creating clones of it. You know, reverse engineer a lot of the code to make like IBM programs work on these new PCs. And it's so fascinating. There are a bunch of lawsuits as a result of that. And now we have the market we have today, right? There is no IBM PC. There's just a PC because anybody can basically create a clone of the PC. Not so much with the Mac, and Apple's been really good with that stuff, at basically suing any Mac clones out of existence. Anyways, that's the writer of the book. Martin Morazzo is the artist. Of course, Martin has a great name because it's my name. And he is also one of the, he's the artist and co-creator for Ice Cream Man, a book from Image that I really, really love. It's creepy AF, as the kids say. Colors by Miroslav Marva and letters by Clem Robbins. Now, I don't know how I want to talk about this book. I will say, first of all, this is part of a new line at Dark Horse, Burger Books. Why they need to create a new line, I don't know, but that's fine. I read the synopsis a little bit, what was it, last week on Tuesday's episode, I would assume, on the Comic Predictor. And it was really fascinating the way the synopsis was done. And then I read the book. And I'm going to say this about this book. When I first read it, I kind of hated it. I kind of hated it. But then as I continued reading it and I thought about what I was reading, it's really brilliant. It's a brilliant book. It's extremely well told, fantastic narration. The characters have way too many layers, and are way too well developed for such a first issue. For a first issue. I mean, it's ridiculous how much you learn about these characters. The main character is not the Flying Woman. In fact, the Flying Woman, I would say, takes a backseat to the story, because even though in the synopsis it seemed like this mysterious Flying Woman was going to be the central focus of the book, that's not the case at all. And basically, I'll recap. There's, out of nowhere, there's a woman flying through the air, and it's all over the news, and everyone's following this Flying Woman, and she doesn't do much. She just flies around, and one day, all of a sudden, she's flying around and blows up. And then we learn about how people in this world react to that and how they interact with each other. And the main character is extremely flawed. Of course, she wants to learn how to fly, so she follows the Flying Woman quite a bit. But she is extremely mentally ill. And so a lot of the issue focuses on her mental illness. And it's really interesting, her family dynamic as well. Like, her grandma is definitely a total hippie. She's like doing meditation all the time and this and that and the other. It does seem like she has a pretty good family life though. I don't remember seeing anybody like yelling at each other or being at each other's throats or anything. Everyone's very friendly with each other, very happy-go-lucky. But she is not very well. She, of course, goes to see a therapist, but there's a lot in here about how she views the world, and some of it is really crazy. I don't want to use that word. I know we're talking about mental illness, so maybe I shouldn't say that. But really outrageous, some of these thoughts that she has, right? Like, she'll just be watching TV, and like, her grandma gave her a little cactus plant, right? So she's like, hey, you should take care of this cactus plant, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh, it's beautiful, blah. And she looks at it, and in her mind, like, she goes to eat it, and then she like wants to kill her grandma. But none of that's actually happening, right? It's all in her head. And she has a lot of violent tendencies where she hallucinates or imagines herself killing people or like mutilating people or animals or things like that. And it's really interesting, right? Because, I mean, her life doesn't seem too bad, but what's the motivation for all of this stuff, right? What has happened to her previously? You know, there's a whole cast of characters aside from her family as well. Like, there's a guy and a hooker that I'm not sure what the deal is there yet. There's a guy who apparently is a scientist who maybe built the device that was helping this woman, the Flying Woman, fly, even though he says he hasn't. There's a covert agency of Chinese spies that are after this guy, because apparently they hired him to create this flying device. And, you know, he's like, I didn't create it. And they're like, listen, you have a choice. You can either create it and we take you back to China and you live a rich man forever, or you don't create it and we take you back to China and make you wish you had created it. So really interesting stuff. I want to know how all these things connect. And, you know, having watched Halt and Catch Fire, there's definitely a very strong payoff as you continue watching the season. And I think that might just be this guy's writing style, because it definitely shows in here as well. And I think this will be one of those books where it might take 3 or 4 issues to really understand what the story is. But definitely don't go into this book thinking you'll get a superhero story, because that is not it whatsoever. And, you know, I know sometimes when they write the synopses for the solicits or whatever, they try to make it extra, extra interesting so that people will pick up the book. I wish they had been phrased a little bit differently, because I think the book itself is brilliant. It's fascinating. There's so much character in here, right? And I love character development. But it's not quite what I expected, you know? And so as a result, that threw me off. And I think that might throw a lot of people off. But really, really fascinating stuff. She Could Fly #1, I think, has a lot of potential to be a great, great series. And, you know, if you're looking for something very different, very much about, you know, we're going to use the term again, the comic veritas, right? The slice of life stuff. Then this will be up your alley. And, you know, there's horror elements in here. There's a little bit of superhero elements. There's the spy thriller elements. I really, really dug it. 4 out of 5 on this one as well. Very briefly, and I mean really briefly, I'll talk about Superman #1. Of course, Brian Michael Bendis with Ivan Reis and Joe Prado. And this is the issue we've all been waiting for. And I want to know what you thought about this one, because I really liked it. I got to say. I like that Bendis is resetting some things, changing some things just enough where they'll make more sense in his story, but not enough where it's really going to piss a lot of people off. And I'm sure there's people that are totally angry about Superman and Action Comics, but you know what? Whatever. I think it's really well done. There's a couple issues that I had with this book, and I want to talk about those a little bit more than the stuff that I liked. By the way, I'm just going to rate it right now as a result. It's a 4 out of 5. I love this book. I thought it was brilliant. The art is fantastic. The emotion of Lois, you know, recalling memories of him and, of Clark, recalling memories of him and Lois, of him and John, his son, were brilliant. Really well done. There's stuff in here about the Fortress of Solitude, because of course it was destroyed in Man of Steel. So he needs to create a new one. And spoiler alert, he does, and it's in the Bermuda Triangle. Why that is, I don't know. I mean, they could have kept it where it was. He could have just rebuilt it. But whatever, it was still awesome. I love seeing the new Fortress of Solitude getting built. And of course, the stuff at the Daily Bugle, because Clark is still a journalist. And, you know, he's not always Superman, even though he kind of is always Superman. And that's one of the things that gets touched upon in this issue. Which leads me to the one thing that I wasn't a big fan of. So there's a really good interaction between Superman and Martian Manhunter, which of course they had a great interaction as well in Justice League 3, the latest issue, which I really enjoyed. Now, as much as I've been enjoying the Bendis stuff, I gotta say I wasn't a big fan of the way he portrayed John Johns in here, the Martian Manhunter. I don't think the voice was quite right, and I wonder if maybe there's not a little bit more going on that we're not kind of seeing. Because basically, the way that I read it at least is, what Martian Manhunter is saying is, look, people need somebody to look up to. You know, if we're going to survive into the future past all these threats that we have, we need a really strong leader who can see the bigger picture. He's like, and you're that leader. Which kind of threw me off, because the way that it read as I was reading it made it kind of seem like John Johns wants Superman to take over the world. And, you know, we've seen some of that stuff in Elseworlds stories in particular. And I think it was, what was the other one? In The Dark Knight as well, the Frank Miller stuff. We saw that, and it doesn't usually go very well when Superman is the guy in charge. Now, I know it's not our Superman, so, you know, maybe it could be better if it was. I do like the idea of, like, Emperor Superman. I don't know what it is about it. I think it could work. And I think every time it's been done, I mean, I loved it, right? I really love when they do these fresh new takes on things. That's what the Elseworld line's about. Or Black Label now, I guess. But, It just seemed a little out of character for John Johns to say that. And maybe I read it wrong, so if I did, let me know. But the cool thing was that, like, Superman isn't really paying attention to anything that's being said because he's always trying to save the world. So, like, he's talking to John, and John's like, hey, yeah, like, you know, this one thing you did really made a difference. And he's like, wait, hold that thought. And he goes and, like, punches a monster in the face and comes right back. He's like, yeah, so you were saying? And John keeps talking. He's like, wait, hang on a second. And there's, like, a giant fire and a building collapsing. And, of course, he goes and tries to save that. He's like, you know, I appreciate it. He's like, I want to give you this idea. The world needs you. He's like, wait. Hang on a second. Just hold that thought. And he goes out into space and, like, helps his astronaut. And he comes right back. He's not really sure what to think about this whole thing, right? And I'm going to read kind of what this says. John says, we can be a global community. We can be a galactic community. And I will lead you there. And Superman says, me? If not you, who? Could it be that the only thing the world needs more than Superman is a Superman who is actively leading the world into its future? A Superman who is ready to take this great civilization to the stars? And Superman says, lead the world? Take over all of it and set it onward to a future in which hope isn't just an ideal, but a... And Superman says, take? And now he gets a little angry. And John says, offer yourself. Watch what happens. Watch the world rise up. They want something different, something more, something hopeful. I love you, John, but think about it. Sit with it. If not you, then who? Superman says, it was really good to see you. And kind of flies off. Really odd, right, that John would say that. And I wonder if this is actually John? Or, I don't know. It seemed odd. Let me know what you think about that. I don't want to keep talking about that one particular thing. But this whole interaction was really weird to me. And I wonder if maybe this is not our Martian Manhunter. Maybe it's one of the white Martians or something. I don't know. But obviously Superman is not very pleased because he is a beacon of hope, right? And I guess maybe what John is trying to tell him is, hey, like, you're a beacon of hope. Why don't you use that to give the whole world hope and lead us to a hopeful future? But I don't think Superman's very thrilled with that. I hope that gets explored. I'm sure Bendis is going to be in this book for like 30 years, right? So he's probably going to retire from comics at DC. So I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to read the story. Anyways, as the story progresses, we see that the Phantom Zone is maybe engulfing Earth, or the Earth is somehow entered into the Phantom Zone. And we know from the last issue of Man of Steel that that's where Rogol Zar is. So the book ends with Rogol Zar returns next. But I really, really dug it. Superman number one. I think I'm glad Superman is in a place where I can continue to love it. You know, and I've loved all the Rebirth stuff. So I'm glad that we have this new direction and a new creative team. And I can still really love what's going on. So high praise for Superman number one. That's going to be a 4 out of 5 as well. And briefly, I want to touch on Hawkman number two. I got to tell you, Venditti, Robert Venditti, you, sir, are a genius. I love this book. It's really good to read a Hawkman book that, yes, it dives into all that history stuff. And, you know, part of me does wish somebody would do something other than, well, let me find out who I am kind of thing. But I think the way that Venditti's doing it is really interesting and well done. And actually makes me want to read the book. I know that's weird, right? That a writer would want to reread his book. But, yeah, it's interesting. So this one has Carter Hall going to this temple that he himself had unearthed in Egypt 100 years prior, and he himself donated to this museum. And it was when he was Khufu, his Egyptian incarnation. So we learn a little bit about Khufu and how he created this belt that helped him fly. We see this temple that has strange hieroglyphics, and there's a trapped Hawkman figure inside it. And, you know, Khufu talks a lot about that. We learn about other incarnations in here of the Hawkman, like Silent Night. The one that I thought was really interesting was Nighthawk, which is a Western series from 50s? I want to say the 50s. And then a little callback to the Birdman, which is a cult on Easter Island. And actually, that was really interesting because I'm listening to a podcast right now that is diving into Easter Island's history. And right now, I'm at the point where they move from the Moab culture, which is the culture that built the giant heads on Easter Island, to the Birdman culture. And the Birdman culture is really interesting because they basically it's like a race to get this bird egg, and whoever gets it becomes the leader of the tribe for a year. And this repeats every year, so it's a very democratic process of election. Anyway, so I love that the Birdman was thrown in here. And a lot of the issue has to do with Carter Hall trying to figure out what the monument's connection is to himself. And so he goes to the museum, the British Museum. He's researching stuff in there. While he's looking over the hieroglyphs, somehow he's turned into Hawkman and transported back to ancient Egypt. And him and Khufu start fighting it out because Khufu thinks that this is the hawk figure that he built a temple for, and the one that's going to kill him. And of course, that's not actually true. And through this fight, Carter Hall says a word. I can't remember. It's a name of a place. Kal something. I wish I remember what it was. Kalmoran. And Khufu's like, Kalmoran, how do you know that word? And of course, they don't understand each other, but they understood Kalmoran. And, that's when Carter Hall as Hawkman gets a hint that there was something in one of these, in one of the columns, like a hidden artifact. And he opens it up and it's a map. And, so he gets out of the museum and is going to use this map to figure out a little bit more about who he is and what these visions of Hawk people are. And then apparently we're going to Dinosaur Island. So that's pretty awesome. Overall, I really dug it though. I think, this might be some of my favorite Brian Hitch art, by the way. Really, really dig it. And, of course, Venditti is just the best. And I gotta say, if you really like this book, then I highly recommend you go and pick up, The Wrath of the Eternal Warrior, because it, in many ways, it seems like the inspiration for this story is somewhat based on that. You know, another character who's lived many lives, even though he remembers those lives, but, really fascinating stuff. All right, let's get on to Farmhand number one from Image Comics. And, you know, if you're a fan of Chu, you'll like this. I didn't read all of Chu, but I love Rob Guillory, and I really love this book. As you can tell by the cover, if you pick this up, there's something afoot on this farm. No pun intended. I actually did not mean to make that pun, but there's something going on this farm, and we learn very quickly what it is. So, the story opens up with, our main character. And he is a journalist, and he's been kind of away from his family for quite a while. And, or not his family, his dad for quite a while. He's got his own family. He got married, he has two kids, and the kids don't really know the grandfather. So it's been, I mean, it looks like at least 7-8 years since he's seen his dad. And it opens up with this nightmare that he has, very creepy, very body horror type nightmare that he has. And when he wakes up, he's like, okay, you know, we're going to go see my dad. And there's a lot of interaction about the family, who they are, how the kids interact with each other. Really, really interesting stuff. They go to see his dad. And his dad used to be just a regular farmer. And they go through this whole speech and a little VR tour that the family goes through. But basically, he finds a way to change stem cells so that they can be really whatever they want to be, and mixes that in with plant DNA so that the plants basically grow human body parts. And that has gotten investment from a genetics company. So, of course, this is a huge business for him. And it's hard to explain everything that you see, but there's some really fascinating stuff, right? Like there's these trees suspended in a pool of liquid, and out of their roots grow human brains. There's trees that have the limbs are actual arms, like actual limbs. There's trees where there's fingers growing out of them, and the fingers have flowers on them. It's just really imaginative stuff on here. And, you know, I would do it a disservice to try to explain every little bit of things that we see here. But the world that's being built here is just absolutely brilliant. And there's definitely horror elements here, so don't get me wrong. But it's a really fun read, right? The characters are a lot of fun to read about and see how they interact, how the kids are learning about this world that their grandfather lives in and has created. Really fascinating stuff. Now, this place, of course, is open to tourists, and there's always like school buses coming in to learn about this place. And in one of these tours is a little kid that comes in, and he goes into one of the greenhouses and grabs a little finger off the tree, and it's really weird. He like opens his arm up, and there's a little compartment so he can put the finger in. And of course, he gets caught, and he's like a freaking ninja, man. Like, he is kicking all the bodyguards' butts in the farm. And one of them goes to see the grandfather. He's like, "Hey, we have weeds down in the in the garden. So the grandfather goes and talks to this little kid, who actually is a little kid. I thought maybe he was just like, I don't know, one of those diseases, you know? Anyways, he's actually a little kid, and he's being hired by a competitor of the grandfather. And, you know, the guy talks to him. He's like, look, you're missing your arm? He's like, I can give you an arm. He's like, here's this tree full of arms. He's like, you don't need to do this. You know, I don't know what this company has against you or, you know, holding against you, but you don't need to do it. Matter of fact, I'm going to help you. Here's an arm. And when that arm comes up, it's creepy, man. Like, the guy chops the arm off the tree and just throws it on the ground, and the arm, like, crawls over to him. And when he goes to attach it, it, like, pops up these fangs that attaches it to the guy. And you know, it looks a little weird, right? It's, like, green and creepy and wrinkly. But it doesn't stay that way, right? Once it attaches to the host, it kind of combines its DNA with the host DNA. And really interesting stuff. We'll see if maybe there's not a little bit more to that, because we do see that character in the last page, and or in the epilogue, by the in not the last page, in the epilogue. And it looks like he's got a little flower bud coming out of the arm. Now, I don't know if that's part of the story or just a pinup or something, but really interesting. I thought this first issue of Farmhand was just brilliant. I cannot recommend this enough. There's a lot to like if you're a horror fan, because there's a lot of body horror stuff in here. But, you know, if you just like a fun story that's imaginative and creative and can do crazy things and not give two craps about it, then, this is really, really good. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Farmhand number one is going to be a 5 out of 5 for me. Really fantastic. I want to talk about the last book of the week. This is going to be a 5 out of 5 too. So I'll get that out of the way. This is 12 Devils Dancing number one from Action Lab Danger Zone, written by Erica Schultz with art by David Costa, colors by Andrew Covault. Fantastic cover by Kelly Williams. Love this cover. Now, when I picked this up, I found something really interesting. If you look at the solicits, this book actually does not come out until Wednesday, this Wednesday. However, this I purchased last Wednesday. Here's the really interesting bit about it. If I go and search for 12 Devils Dancing in Comixology, no results show up. I mean, by the time you listen to this, maybe you'll see it on there, because Comixology does put the pages up a few days before they come out. But if you search for it, you won't find it. If you go to the Action Labs Danger Zone page, you won't find it. If you go to Erica Schultz page on Comixology, you won't find it. Now, you could do a search for 12 Devils Dancing Comixology, or you can go on Erica's Twitter or Action Labs Twitter, and if there's a tweet in there, then you'll actually get to the page and you can purchase it there. So before I continue, if you plan on picking this up in print, it comes out in print this Wednesday. So you may not want to listen to this conversation, but I'm going to make this my pick of the week for last week, because I read this last week. And there must have been a snafu, because the print release, I just looked at this. The digital release date on here says July 18th now, and when I read this last week, it said July 11th, with a print release of July 18th. Anyways, I'm talking way too much about this minor technicality. Let's talk about this book. So, 12 Devils Dancing is about an FBI agent, Callum Cooper, who is, he retires, okay? He just got done arresting the crypto killer, who's a serial killer, very gruesome. He just got done arresting him. The guy got indicted. He's going to jail forever. And, Callum is not doing very well personally. He's got a lot of issues, psychological issues. He's got a lot of, anxiety issues. He gets like the shakes in his hands. So he's not doing very well. And so he's kind of made to retire. Okay. Not quite forced to, but medically suggested by his shrink, who also happens to be his ex-boyfriend, that he should retire. We do learn quite a lot about this guy. In fact, it opens up with some backstory about Callum, because he was a member of a, I would say maybe a Christian cult of some sort. We don't know really a whole lot about it. We know that it's a very strict cult. We know that there were a lot of kids in the cult. We know that the reverend that was in charge of the cult very strongly believe in corporal punishment. And we get that a little bit later. Before I continue, let me say, this is a $5.99 book. So let me get that out of the way. $5.99 book. However, there's basically three issues in one here. So you do get a three-part story. I can't remember what the page count is on this. But you do get a three-page or three-part story. 66 pages. Well, makes sense. 22 pages per book. Anyways, so this FBI agent has retired. After he retires, it turns out that maybe he needs to come back to work because maybe the crypto killer guy that he caught is not the actual crypto killer. Maybe it's somebody else. And we do get a reveal of who it is. Matter of fact, in the third part of the first issue, we do learn who it is. And as it turns out, there is a very personal connection to Callum Cooper himself, the FBI agent. And I love this book. So I love cult stuff. Okay. I love reading about cults. I listen to a podcast about cults, very imaginatively called Cults. I love that kind of stuff. I love watching TV shows about cults. What was the one? Was it called The Cult? Maybe it was called The Cult. That was a really good show. Anyways, I also love serial killer stuff. I love reading about them. I love watching documentaries on them. I love listening to the Serial Killers podcast, also very imaginatively titled. I love that kind of stuff because I love to know how people work and why they believe the things they believe and how they believe those things and how those things affect the way that they see the world. And that's basically what this book is about. You know, it's almost like reading a comic book version of Seven in some ways. There's a lot of gruesomeness here. There's a lot of violence. And so if some of that stuff kind of turns you off, maybe you want to stay away. Although I will say, you know, the first couple of parts, there's not a whole lot of that. I think in part three of this first issue, we do see at least one body opened up. And of course, the serial killer does make paintings with the blood of his victims. But aside from that, like, I don't think it's extremely gruesome where it will turn off some people who are a little squeamish. But yeah, really interesting stuff. And I love how the killer plays with the FBI agent here. You know, he throws clues at him because the FBI agent's always been interested in solving puzzles, like crossword puzzles and whatever else, and has become kind of a crypto analyst, right? And can decipher different ciphers. And some of them are very simple. And the key to the cipher that the crypto killer sends is 12 Devils Dancing, right? Because that's how he signed all his letters to the police. Now, you know, the crypto killer sends this guy on a journey all over the place. Like, he goes to Vegas and he thinks he's got to save this one girl, but he saves the wrong girl. But the girl that he saves actually becomes his partner in trying to research this whole thing. And he kind of tricks her into saying, yeah, I'll get you a job at the FBI. Like, you can help me in the lab or whatever. And, you know, he's not working there anymore because he's been forced to retire. And now there's an investigation because, as it turns out, everybody's found out that the guy that was put in jail, while he may have been a rapist, was not necessarily the crypto killer. And the crypto killer's on the loose. So now they want to do an internal affairs investigation at the FBI, maybe bring Callum in. So things really heat up pretty quickly. And you learn a whole lot about, you know, these characters, this world. And it was fascinating. It was brilliant. I've followed Erica's stuff for quite a while. I really enjoy her work. Matter of fact, I just read I just read This Nightmare Kills Fascists because, Andrew, I think, had a story in there, Andrew Shaw. And there's a lot of great stuff in there. Vida Ayala, who I'm really digging her stuff nowadays. Ryan Ferrier's in there, Tinny Howard, Justin Jordan, of course, Erica Schultz, Eric Palicki, Chris Sabella. Man, a lot of great stuff on there. I really recommend This Nightmare Kills Fascists. Anyways, Erica's got a story in there, and really, really dug that. She's also currently writing Xena Warrior Princess, if I'm not mistaken. Anyways, I think Erica's going to be on the show next week. Next week or the week after. I'll have to look at my schedule. But yeah, really, really fantastic stuff. First of all, I've been really digging the Action Lab Danger Zone stuff. If you like really good comics that are more on the indie front, then definitely check out some of the stuff that Action Lab Danger Zone's putting out. Medicine by Action Lab Danger Zone is still one of my favorite books of the last couple of years. Really fantastic stuff. Of course, Spencer and Locke, which may still be my favorite book that I've read this year. I gotta think about that because I've read so many good stuff nowadays. But at the time that I read it, it was my favorite book that I've read of the year. And I'm excited because that book's coming out with a volume 2. I know that was just announced. Hardcore Legacy. I don't know. There's a lot of really good stuff over there. You know, like I said, like I always say, I always think of like Zombie Tramp when I think of Action Lab and, Zombies. What's the other one? Danger Doll? Action Lab's got really great stuff. So highly, highly recommend it. And 12 Double Dancing is no exception. I think this book was so brilliant. So brilliant. You know, there's so much character development, so much action, so much intrigue. And, you know, when we get the reveal of who the serial killer is, you're like, of course it's that guy. Now it makes total sense. And it does have a very personal relationship to Callum, as I said. So really enjoyed it. I love the story, love the art. Highly, highly recommend it. I don't know if these are all going to be full-sized or oversized issues. My assumption is just the first one, and then we'll get to back to a regular-sized comic. But I love when publishers do this kind of thing because, you know, it gives me – you know, telling a first issue is hard, right? You only have 22 pages to tell a story. That's not a long time to introduce you to a world. And I love when publishers do this kind of thing where they tell a longer first issue. I think this should be like mandatory for basically every first issue, that they should all be at least 32 pages. I think that would give the extra 10 pages would definitely allow the additional information you need to really start caring about a book, right? Sometimes it's hard to figure out if you want to read something past an issue one, but I think with the additional length, it definitely helps. And with this book being 66 pages, it definitely, definitely helps. So 12 Devils Dancing number one. Again, you may have read this last week. This comes out this week. It's going to be a 5 out of 5. That is going to wrap it up for this episode of Comic Talk Today. Thank you all for listening, and thank you all for sticking with me. I will be back tomorrow with a new episode. Of course, we'll be doing the news, which there won't be a whole lot of news because San Diego Comic Con's coming up. Of course, we'll do the comic predictor. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you there.